If you could get rid of everything bad about banks and build one from scratch, you'd build a different kind of bank. One that has actual people you can talk to 24/7, not robots, doesn't invest in fossil fuels, charges no extra fees for spending abroad, and definitely doesn't close before you finish work. You'd build tools to help manage bills, teach kids good money habits, and give interest on personal and joint accounts. So what would that look like? Starling Bank. The bank built for you.
You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network, the premier source for role-playing game entertainment. Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Network.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. It is Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, and I'm your old pal, Joe O'Brien.
And I'm Troy, returning to my homeland this week, La Valley.
Returning to the homeland of Canada, French Canada.
You know my people are from Canada.
I know that from your weird last name, La Vallée, as I pronounce it when I first met you.
Also incorrect, it would be La Vallée.
La Vallée.
La Vallée. Off misspelled. Every honor roll, all the newspapers would spell it. Like every time, it's like, oh, let's see, capital V, great. One E, one L. But I remember it must have been like fifth grade. You had to do like your dress as your heritage, you know, or like whatever the fuck it was. And everybody's like coming in looking like Chef Boyardee, all the Italians or the Irish. And I remember feeling like, man, what the hell am I? And I just came in dressed as a Mountie. Got this like sick Mountie uniform, but I always felt like French Canadian seems like such a lame heritage, but now I embrace it. I could have got citizenship, you know, like 5-6 years ago. They still allowed like people whose family
mongrels
came from there.
Mongrels that come over from the U.S. and demand citizenship.
I think they used to allow it, and now they don't do it anymore. But I wish I had known. I got way into it for like a hot second. My mother-in-law had us all do the like 23andMe or fucking Ancestry.com
thing. Ancestry.com, John.
And so she was way into that, and so I was like, let me take a peek at that. So I got into it, and like my mother's side of the family, I can trace all the way back to like the kings of England. There's like royal blood.
Yeah.
And then like my father's side, it goes into Canada and then it just like stops at like my great, great grandfather. And they always said that in the family, there was this like rumor that I must have been my great, great grandfather like married a Penobscot Indian woman. And the trees for those, for that nation or whatever wasn't as, that tribe wasn't as robust as the Cour des Bois French Canadians. But anyways, I'm excited to go home.
Excited to go back. It is show week this week, ladies and gentlemen. For the first time in 2024, we hit the road on Friday, flying to Canada.
Hit the road,
and
Jack.
I mean, I say we're flying to Canada. I don't know if we'll actually get out of the airport. We'll see what customs does. I mean, I'm not going to assume anything at this point. This is definitely the first time that I've gone to a foreign country and been like, I'm working here. I'm doing some work.
Yeah.
And I'm just worried I'm going to get jacked up against the wall, handcuffed.
Gun in your back.
Gun to the back of my head.
Please.
I'm just a podcaster.
Please.
I'm just a podcaster. Cut to the camera shot at the bottom of my pants as the pee leaks out.
Dude, I hate going through customs. Even when I have nothing to hide, I just assume, not that I do have something to hide, but like I always assume the worst. It's like getting pulled over. It's like, your posture straightens
you're like,
up.
I know there's no heroin in this car. I know there's no heroin in this car. Why am I freaking out?
I remember just like driving cheese curds back across the border, and like you're not allowed to do that technically. And like, please don't search underneath my back seat. There's cheese curds there and gravy. But yeah, I hate going through it. I'm assuming the worst. I'm flying out a little later than usual, like 11 a.m. I usually fly out at like 7 because I like just fucking get there.
Yeah.
And then I'm flying back at like noon because same thing. I'm assuming the worst. They'll be like, how much money did you make this weekend? I'll be like, I don't know. I won't know for a couple weeks. So yeah, it's going to be besides that, I'm excited to get to Toronto. I'm excited to get back on the road. Been working on the fucking sizzle that Harry put together, kind of redoing some stuff with that, working on like the intro video. And man, it really brings me back to everything that we did last year, because it all happened so fast. There's always so much going on. And between that and like just going through all my taxes for the year, I kind of like get to relive all these memories of like 2023, and you just forget stuff. And I even texted the group the other day, like, I'm so excited to get back on the road with you guys. Because there were just so many fun things that we did that probably none of you guys remember until you see the sizzle.
Yeah. It was also the first full year traveling with this cast, you know, yeah. Like early last year, we had not regularly traveled on the road with Kate and Sydney. And so it was just really fun doing 13 shows, whatever we did with them. It was great. And now we've had a nice little break since the holidays. And also, if you think about it, though, it was since late October that we've flown, you know, because we just went to Philly in December. So, I mean, it's been a long time since we've gotten out there together, took a flight and went to do a show, and also just flat out played Strange Aeons, which I'm so excited to play because I love that AP and I love those characters. So I'm really excited to get back to that.
Yeah, I would have loved to get a power session going like we had talked about before Toronto, but it's just like we got slammed with a bunch of exciting things that just made it impossible. But I'm still pretty dedicated to making sure that we do off tour sessions of it, because I just want to chunk through this, get to book five as soon as possible.
It's going to be great. I hope that we can play some more off tour as well. So real quick, we're just going to hit a couple quick news items before getting to the episode, which we'll talk about for a little bit. And then, of course, some We Are Stupid and a little bit more listener mail, just because this week's episode is going to be a little bit light to dig into because it's because of that Cliffy. So we'll talk about that as we get to it. But first off, yes, heading to Toronto this weekend. Very excited. Sold out show. Excited to premiere this week's tour in front of our Canadian fans who have been so gracious for so many years to travel down to so many shows. Yeah. I see Canadians, obviously, in New York and Boston, but I see Canadians in Chicago. I saw Canadians in St. Louis, Canadians in Seattle and Portland. So it's great for us to be able to come to your turf and play an away game. And I'm really, really looking forward to that. And So Canada this week. Troy mentioned that we've got some exciting things in the works. That's true. And we're not going to talk about any of that today because it's very early on a few of these things. But there's some new stuff broiling in the background in terms of content for us, stuff we've never done before. And we're really looking forward to sharing that with you.
Is it broiling or brewing?
Brewing.
Yeah, if it was broiling, it would be like, broiling, like slowly cooking it over a high heat.
No. That's we're just burning the shit out of it before it ever gets out.
Burning the shit out of some exciting content behind the scenes.
So we're working on some stuff. I have a feeling that literally by next week's FOD, we could have some news on this stuff. But if not, probably in about 2 weeks.
One contract went out. I think it was signed. Once that check fucking clears, we could talk about that.
Yeah, I'm not talking about it until people are, you know, whatever. I'm not going to say anything. Let's keep it moving for now. But we'll have some exciting stuff to talk about in the next couple weeks. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, man.
We've been streaming week in and week out, you and I, and this week is no different. You're going to be playing today, right? Baldur's Gate at 2:00 today.
2 p.m. Eastern.
If you're hearing this early on Wednesday, it is 2:00 Eastern today, Wednesday, March 13th, back into the Baldur's Gate. I love that you're streaming, like just streaming this campaign story of Stiff Dickerson. I love it.
Old Stiff Dickerson is doing well. Last week we finished the stream pretty close to the end of Act 2, and I've been playing off air. I'm now in Act 3, and I don't like it so far, actually. It's a lot of like interactions with people, and as someone who is like a completionist, I just feel like I got to talk to every single fucking person to make sure that I'm unlocking any quests. So far I'm not a huge fan of it, but I know I will be. I've heard Act 3 is amazing. But there's just a lot going on. I'm at the point now where I'm like, I'm ready. I'm ready to just let's finish this game and move on.
Is Act 3 the last act? The final
act? 3
is
the last act. Yeah. Oh, okay. From what I've read, it's as large as Act 1. Okay. And so far I've done I've done everything quest-wise that you know has come up. I think I've exhausted all my quests. I don't have any dangling quests that are unfinished, but I want to try and do everything, and so that just takes a little bit longer.
Awesome. I am going to play some more Pacific Drive this week because, I mean, it was a wild and really fun stream. You saw none of this, right?
No.
So, and you know it. I mean, last time we talked about it, I didn't even know really what it was. But it is basically like a supernatural, almost like Cthulian-esque, like exploration horror survival game set in the Pacific Northwest, where you have to literally drive a car into these abandoned areas where this supernatural event happened, and all of the Pacific Northwest is like walled off, and you do these missions where you like drive in. You try to get some shit and find out what's going on, and then you drive out before you die. And it's always so tense. And what ends up happening is like your car gets dinged up. And so when you come out, you have to like fix up your car, basically.
What a weird idea for a game.
It's a very, very weird idea for a game, but it creates a play loop that is extremely entertaining, where the first couple times that I got past like the earliest tutorial stuff, and this was on stream, and started really like understanding what was happening, I started getting way more precious with my car, because it's like the damage to your car is very hard to fix, and it takes a lot of resources and stuff. So like you'll be like racing away from some sort of horrible creature and like nick the side of a tree and be like, God damn it. Like there goes my right headlight. And you'll know you have to pay to fix that and shit. Like it just creates a vibe and a feeling unlike any game I've played before. And it's really fun and really interesting. And all of the mystery stuff, it's interesting, and it makes you want to go back in and find out what the hell happened here, because they don't tell you what happened. They just say something happened, and I'm sure you're going to find out that mystery. That mystery will unfold as you go. But anyway, I'm going to play that tomorrow, Thursday, at 1 o'clock Eastern on Twitch, if you want to come by and check out a strange but really fun and really like tense game. I just thought that it made a great stream game because the tension is like – no, like at all times, you're just like cruising. It's almost like a Walking Dead kind of thing where you're like cruising down a road that's abandoned, you know, but you never know if something's going to come out of nowhere. And you're like, what? You got to like turn around and start speeding away. I mean, it's just
wild. Playing on console or PC?
Oh, PS5. Yeah. PS5.
Nice, dude. Nice.
It's fun. All right.
Can't wait to play a new game.
One more piece of news here before, actually.
Well,
you know,
I do have an extra hot off the press news. St. Paul VIP. Sold out.
We love you, St. Paul.
Couple left in Nashville, handful left in Denver. Denver and KC, I gave you shit last week. I also gave you shit on Twitter. You're doing a little better. KC, doing better than Denver. But Denver, bottom of the barrel right now.
Wow, come on, Denver.
Tour sales. Yeah, I guess they don't want us to ever come back. Poor Skid. Poor Skid. Poor he loves going there.
Skid.
And he'll never be allowed back.
Even like for personal visits?
Yep, can't do it.
Sorry, Skid. Can't do it. Speaking of the tour, real fast, there's new merch that's coming out for Toronto. We already talked about this, but just letting everybody know, this should be as early as next Monday or Tuesday. If you're not going to be at the Toronto show, you should be able to see this stuff on the web store. The Bird shirt.
The Bird
and
shirt.
And the OG GCP hat, the return, the reboot of the OG GCP hat are coming back. So,
dude, the Bird shirt looks awesome.
I can't wait to get one. I'm like, I am straight up stealing one. I don't give a shit.
It really, you know, when a conversation started, like people be like, what the fuck is that? Well, you have an hour and a half. I can explain. There's this podcast I listen to, but it looks great. It's really, I'm going to have you guys do more like shitty drugs.
Well, you know what? I mean, we'll see. But I feel like that was a one-time thing. It just like all the events came, the stars aligned in that moment. It's just too funny. All right, so there is something weird I want to talk about, and I'm very excited about this. This Ooh. Is for subscribers, particularly our Vorpal level subscribers.
Yes,
on our subscription service, we part of the reward for that is a Talk Nerdy Town Hall. We've talked about this before. We've done it where it's just kind of like a one of the founders of the company goes on Discord and just chats with you guys, and we have a little bit of a back and forth. This time, I want to get a little bit more aggressive with it, and I want to try a little bit of a new format. So next week, next Wednesday, the day that the next fodder releases, March 30th, right? Is that right? No, 20th, sorry. March 20th, Wednesday, March 20th. I'm going to do a Talk Nerdy Town Hall. I'm going to do it with Jared Logan, and we're going to utilize the new Discord Stages functionality.
Try to use it.
And in doing so, it is our intention to, for the first time, instead of talking with you while you guys chat, we're going to literally bring people onto the stage, so to speak, and have conversations with anybody that wants to chat about the topic of conversation for the day. So we are going – it's going to be kind of like a talk radio show. It's a little tester that we're doing, and I hope that it works out well. But if you're a Vorpal subscriber, come by next Wednesday, the 20th, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. It'll be in the evening for an hour. We'll hang out and we'll – test this functionality. And if you want to come up on stage, hear, let your voice be heard in front of the nation about whatever you want to talk about, great. We'll do it. And then whatchamacallit? If you are not at the Vorpal tier and want to get there, that is $25 a month, right? So if you are interested in checking it out, you want to jump up to the Vorpal tier.
25, yep. 270 yeah. a year. Get a discount if you do annual.
$270 a year, you get a discount if you do annual. So if you want to come and check it out, I think it's going to be really fun. And if it goes well, we're going to do more of these. So definitely come by and check it out. That's next Wednesday, the 20th, 7:30 Eastern time. Talk Nerdy Town Hall with the voices of the Nash live being heard. And I'm going to work to record that all as well. So it'll be released after. And if I do it right, I've been testing it. You should be able to hear the recordings of the people that came on stage as well. So
by kicking this off, we're going to be doing the town hall every month. It won't always be like this. I can tell you that because like when I do it, I'm not going to do that version of it, but Joe and Jared are into it and I think they should give it a try. Hopefully no one will, spout obscenities that we have to edit out afterwards or try to sink the company.
I know we have to have like a drop button, kill button. What do they call it? There's a name for it in radio.
We're going to kick it off. So that every month, starting with this month from now on, you'll get at least one town hall as part of that tier. It took us a while to get it going, but, now we're ready, and I don't know. I just think the Discord community has grown so much. It'll be fun to do more interactive stuff that's just on there.
Yes. Couldn't agree more. All right, let's talk about Glass Cannon Podcast Campaign 2, episode 25. Opens in one of my favorite settings possible. This crosses over between Pathfinder, Starfinder, Cthulhu, Delta Green. There's just something about a library, man.
You love a library.
Everybody loves a library. I think the library.
You know, I don't care for it.
Well, all right. Yes, I could go either way. Okay. Here's the two ways, right? There's two ways you can go with a library as a GM. On one hand, it is the catch-all opportunity for you to disseminate anything you want to in a very organic way. And that takes a lot of pressure off your shoulders. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's a library with thousands of books. And if you have players that want to dig in and there really isn't much there, that can be painful as a GM trying to be like, well, there's really not much there. Well, what kinds of books are there? I don't know. It doesn't say in the freaking module. Like just this.
Beyond the scope of this adventure.
It's beyond the scope of this adventure. It can be a point of stress. So talk to me about this library, Troy. Was this something you were looking forward to or a point of stress for you? You seemed totally unprepared for disseminating advice on that. You were reading out of the book as you were saying, like, it has this and this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not joking when I say like I could care less about libraries because I'm like, I just don't like to learn about the adventure that way. I like to learn it through action and through like
and dialogue and stuff.
But there wasn't a lot of information there. And I know that's disappointing for you guys because you walk in, you're like, let's go.
Treasure trove, dude.
And I gave you everything. You know, there wasn't a whole lot going on there. You know, I think it's interesting to see what kind of books are in there. That's important because it adds to the mystery. It kind of, if you can think about it, it's revealing clues about what's happening here. Why is Kanipo and Kanipo's associates
researching
interesting?
Diseases. Ancient curses. Elven medicine.
Elven
anatomy.
But what there isn't is like a Kanipo's feelings journal, which is
which is fine. I mean, I guess you can't really expect that. I mean, I remember this coming up in Delta Green season 4 in Impossible Landscapes. It may have been season 5. I can't remember. It's getting a little mixed in my head now. But like going to the New York Public Library as a group to research some of these figures or these NPCs that you hear about that are that were supposedly traipsing around New York City 100 years ago, you know, how are they connected to this whole mystery? And, if, you know, not all the answers – just because it's a library doesn't mean it has all the answers you want,
yeah.
particularly when it comes to really specific kinds of evidence. But a library makes such a great backdrop for any – role-playing game, it's a good set piece
yeah.
to have a fight in, to have a mysterious part in, or to have a horror part in. Like, there's something about libraries that are very interesting, and they draw out emotions in the way that they look and feel. But yeah, they can be a little bit of a point of stress. You did not what I'm gathering is you didn't add any information in here that wasn't already said in the book in order to help us, that something we missed before that you squeezed into the library.
No, I didn't think it was super interesting. You know, I left out one piece that, you know, you guys should be able to figure out on your own. It seems like you guys were getting there. Obviously you did find the spell book with two spells.
Yes.
And then the three books, the Osirian Scroll on Magical Blights, a rare unburned copy of Curses Foul and Fell bound in eel hide, and a beautifully illuminated copy of The Physicker's Guide to Elves. The real importance of those three things is that they're worth 7 gold each if you try to sell them later.
Yeah. It's wild. And it's wild to think of – it's just so strange, right? Because you have a library of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. And what comes out of it that's interesting is three that you could sell. You know what I mean? So how do you know you can't sell the other ones? Like, what makes them so worthless? It's an interesting concept. But those three books do tell you something about this place and this adventure in an interesting way.
For sure. I mean, he's been in here for a long time. He's been like collecting these tomes over the ages.
Yeah.
From his victims, maybe. Like, who knows?
Probably the most interesting thing, though, in the library is a small onyx figurine.
That was in the next room.
Dog. That was in the next room?
That was in the next room. In the next room, there's that dusty old bed. And then in the northern alcove, the most impressive thing you find there is this wondrous dog figure.
I assigned it differently in my mind. Okay, so then we'll move into this next room, which is essentially an examination room, operating room.
There's a lot going on in this room. There's just a bed that looks like this beautiful noble's bed. You're forgetting the middle room. You've already moved on to the operating
yes,
room.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Middle room is this
I'm picturing the library connected to that, to the operating room. Yes, correct.
Yeah, it looks like a noble's bedroom, this pastel fabric hanging, a dusty four-poster bed, and it looks like it's either never been used or hasn't been used in a long, long time. And then in the north end of the room, there's candles, crystals, other occult accoutrements suggesting a spell or magical project in process. And then there's like this half-finished door. And then among those magical things is where you find this onyx dog, wondrous
onyx
figurine.
Doc. All right, we're going to get to that in a second, but let's go into this operating room with a bloody table, these diagrams of people being vivisected, and also like being like, oh my gosh, what's the word I'm looking for?
Like
being added
mutated,
onto,
like, yeah,
mutated,
like
augmented.
Elongated arm. Yeah, augmented. Yeah.
Augmented is the
altered
word, right? In very strange ways. It's like, why is this happening? Why is Kanipo doing this? What is the purpose? And then a creature appears, a creature that seems to be made of shadow stuff, but with a mask on, and says, they are mine. They are mine. And then immediately attacks us. And yeah, pretty wild encounter. We'll talk a little bit more about it in We Are Stupid and such, but let me ask you about the Onyx Dog, because this is how we finish up the episode, is the Onyx Dog being the Kula Khan pulling out and activating the Onyx Dog. Do you expect at the moment that this Onyx Dog is either seen when you're prepping or when Skid picks it up in the bedroom that it's going to be used this quickly?
No, you know, I'm the king of, like, I barely look at treasure. Like, I'll read it. On my first couple read-throughs, I'll copy and paste it to my document. And then, like, day of prep, I'll be like, oh, interesting. But I very rarely will then look and see what that does. I wait till, like, the moment when you guys, like, are rolling our can and check. Yeah, let's see what it does. And I'm like, oh, all right, fine. and then you guys use it. And I'm like, okay. Let me see how I can make this interesting.
So yeah, we'll see how it becomes interesting, because that's the cliffhanger of the episode, is this dog coming out. And I'm sure that it's just kind of a familiar type thing. I can't imagine it being that powerful, but it's a fun way to end the episode, and we'll see where it goes. I don't want to talk too much. I can't really get too much into the enemy or the encounter and such like that, because it's a mid-combat cliffy. I don't think we've had many of these.
It's been a while.
Too many of these in Gatewalkers. Yeah. It hasn't seemed to be your MO. You kind of like to finish out an encounter before you end the episode. Is there anything that jumped out at you in this case? Was it purely like you were running up against the clock? Like, why end the episode where you did?
I just get the sense there's a lot more to this combat than meets the eye, and I didn't want to go another hour. I think it could easily take that long, depending on certain things. I loved that Kay triggered the trap. I was hoping someone would trigger it.
Yeah.
And like, it's one of those traps where I don't even want to roll the check to see if you see it. Like, I just want you to trigger it.
But roll a secret check.
Yeah, I rolled a secret check. She failed, and that was great. I mean, we've talked about ad nauseum at this point. Like, there's nothing better than having a player trigger a trap, and it's a nasty one. And so she fell down there. Obviously it was Cat's Grace, and she didn't take the falling damage, but she did land on those spikes. There's bodies down there. You know, you also are seeing images of these missing people, Varna and Maybelline and Henry Buckets. So like you're finding, at least if not closure, some sort of continuation of that story. It had a little bit of everything, and I felt like, okay, you bringing out the dog, that's a great place to end it, and we'll pick up here next week.
I liked it. Let's talk about the trap for a second. This creates some chatter on the old, I don't know where else, probably everywhere, but what I saw on YouTube, because I monitor the YouTube comments for the purposes of Cannon Fodder.
Yeah.
I like to talk and bring up good comments and discussable comments that people make. And so there were a few like this, but I'm just going to highlight @PrinnyGod on YouTube, who commented, "Joe needs to stop chiming in out of the blue to enforce rules on other players, especially for things that are already around past. Just takes the steam out of the moment and made what would have been a very solid round for Kate deflated. Love the show, but the rules lawyering tied with the overbearing injection is jarring." It is an opinion. It's a valid opinion. I might take some umbrage with the word overbearing injection, but outside interjection. But outside of that, That's your screen name. Your secret screen name is Pretty God.
Yep.
Outside of that, there were multiple comments like this, and it does bring up a question that bears conversation, which is there always a definable statute of limitations on rule corrections?
No, I don't think so. And this was a perfect example why even though a round had passed, that was important. Like, you shouldn't have the bow. The bow fell out of your hands. If you want to climb... We're talking about the bow, right? Bow?
Yeah, you're talking about the bow?
Yeah.
Yes,
I could have said when you fall that you drop the bow, you know? But like, if you want to climb, you need two hands, so there's an action there. You talk, and then I have a thing that I think is really important. It's about the action economy and Pathfinder.
Okay. Well, the only thing that I'll say in terms of the statute of limitations is I think that that's always a GM call. I think that if a player knows something is wrong, at least for me, I would have a really hard time keeping it to myself. And I think that bringing it up, at least for discussion, is important. Unless, look, there are times when you know that the other player that you're talking about at the table can't handle it, right? Like, they will have a breakdown if you call them on this rule.
Right.
And you may know that now is not the time, and that is completely up to you as to when to make those moments. I certainly did not think that was a moment. This was a moment like that for Kate in particular. But I felt like bringing it up and addressing it was important. And the one reason that I felt that the only thing I'm talking about right now is the statute of limitations. The reason I didn't feel that had passed by any stretch is because we had not established that the bow wasn't used. And then later we discovered you couldn't use it. You should have never had it.
Right.
Undo that damage. Put the bow back down there. You know, like, she had just gotten up and had not done anything else yet, and we caught it. So I felt like it was within the statute of limitations. That's all I'll say about that. But go ahead. You go on about the action economy in Pathfinder.
Well, I was going to say, like, for one thing, like, I appreciate it. There's sometimes I feel it, and it happens during the live show, too, where, like, as much as I appreciate you chiming in, I'm like, ooh, that killed the momentum, even though I'm really glad we got that right. It is a tough and almost impossible balance, and no one is spending shame anybody, but like no one is spending more time with the rules than you, even more so than me. And so I appreciate that. I think you're in a very difficult position because I've made it so that I want you to do that. How do you do that in a way that doesn't kill the momentum and make people feel like you're just
picking
on them. It's an impossible position. But like, I, for one, appreciate it because I got a million things going on and I'm not thinking about the nitty gritty rules all the time. I'm thinking about pace. It's a fine line. I think you walk it really well while I also understand people's complaints about it. But what I was going to say about the action economy, going from first edition to second edition, I think that people be like, three actions, let's fucking go. You mean I can do two, three attacks as a first level character? Amazing. I think it's a great thing, and I don't know if I can verbalize this well. A player should think about, like, everything they want to do is an action.
Every single thing.
Everything you want to do, almost. There are some free actions, but for the most part, everything you want to do is an action. So when you say you want to do shit, even if it's cool, think about how many actions it really takes. Like, you would love to be able to stride up and do a two attacks. But if you've got to grab a weapon, if you're leaping on a table, if you're doing this, you've got to pick up this, you've got to stow that, redo it, pull something out. Every little thing costs actions. I think that I'm too
generous
with actions. You know, when someone takes out a potion and drinks it, isn't that two actions?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times I think I'm because I don't want to make anybody mad. I'm like, okay, what else? And then they go on to do two more actions. And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, there's two actions. I want you to police yourself. You got to find that balance. But ultimately, like,
I mean, you
everything
say
you want to do costs an action. And yeah. So you as a player should try to not hinder yourself, but really think about, I want to do this. I want to do this. Well, you've just said three things you want to do. And you may think like, what, just doing this is an action? Yes, that's part of what the way the game has changed. You have the world in front of you now with three actions. But if you're going to do stuff, it costs an action.
Yeah. I think that we, well, you bring up a topic, which is police yourself. And that's a tough one, right? Like, you're trying to tell players at the table, the GM, it's not their job to police you. It is, and some people would say it's a GM's job to know all the rules, at least the most at the table, and to be able to address those rules. That's fine if that's your opinion on how GM should run games.
We don't believe.
But even if that's the case, I still never think it's a GM's job to police the action economy of the players. If you're walking into an area where a player truly doesn't know the game, like that's a different thing. But players that know the game and have been playing it for a long time, they should be able to police themselves. However, all of us at one time or another just forget things. You just forget things. You're also caught up in the moment. Is it another player's job to point that out? Or if the other player, myself in this case, knows that something is wrong, knows that this player honestly just didn't catch it, and knows that the GM just honestly didn't catch it, nobody's cheating, an honest mistake is happening in front of you, do you just say nothing? It's hard. I think you can argue, yes, you just say nothing. But I sit there and it eats me inside.
Yeah.
I can't explain it, because what's going to happen is I feel that asterisk syndrome, like we've talked about before. I hate an asterisk, right? It's like, you don't want to feel like at the end of the fight, you realize you never could have even had that weapon in your hand that you used to crit the boss and finish the end of the book, right? Let's say it's an ultimate encounter kind of thing. Now, some people just don't care about that, and I respect that. But we do this in front of an audience, and there's an audience that polices us. And so when there's people that are like, oh, you couldn't have done this, you couldn't have done this, they'll point it out to that player eventually anyway. And I feel like I would feel bad inside saying like, yeah, I knew that all along, but I just didn't say it, right? It's weird. It's weird. I certainly understand the other issue. So there's multiple issues in this comment. The other one is taking the steam out of the moment, right? So like, is getting the rule right more important than keeping the flow of the moment, which I would say probably not, right? Like, you just,
depends on the rule. It really is dependent on
it is. It's so dependent on
if you
so
crit
many
with
factors.
A scimitar that you technically shouldn't have in your hand. As cool as that is, you can't do it. You know. Dude, right. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but next week's FOD is going to be a must listen because this episode we've already recorded is so fucking wild and so, like, it's kind of old school GCP in a way. I've already said too much, but, like, I think it'll be a really interesting discussion that revolves around what we're talking about.
I'm mad you brought it up, but I do appreciate the hype. Yes, next week's FOD will be juicy for sure, yeah. for many reasons.
Many
but,
reasons.
Anyway, I appreciate the comment. I understand people's frustration with it. I'm always trying to walk that line. And it's just an interesting topic of conversation. I think, you know, comment here on this episode. Let us know how you handle it at your tables. Do you have a player that points things out to other players? Do you tell your players, don't correct other players? You know, it's an interesting, like,
yeah.
Relationship that you have to have around the table to correct somebody else's action during their turn. And by the way, not only do I get rules wrong, I mean, that happens to the best of us, but, like, I correct people sometimes and I'm just blatantly wrong. Like, they're doing it right and I'm wrong. And, like, I can see that being frustrating, but it's also coming from a place of, like, double checking. Like, are you above being double checked? You know what I mean? Like, I just, if anybody ever does it to me, just watch and see how I react. Because if I ever bitch at somebody about pointing out something I did wrong, let me know, because I'd really like to see if I do that. I would want to know. For me personally, like, if somebody's like, well, you already did this, I'd be like, oh my God, you're right. Crap, I can't do it. You know, yeah. I don't know, but I love the rules.
I think that if more people at the table did it, you wouldn't be singled out so much. It wouldn't be as glaring, but no one else does it. Matthew once in a blue moon will do it. And I think it's a combination of, like, personalities different and also, lack of confidence with the rules. No one wants to say
personality.
Actually,
different.
You can't do that because no one feels confident enough with the rule to say that. That's why I think it's totally fine. And again, you got to do this within reason as well to be like, wait a minute, are you sure you can do that? Walk me through that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll do that sometimes. Like, wait a minute. You know,
something seems fishy here. Walk
nobody wants
through,
to look stupid, right? Nobody wants to be like, through. No, you can't do that. And then you're like, yeah, I can. I'm like, oh, sorry.
Yeah, walk me through what you did. I just don't want to ever be – I don't want to ever think of myself as being above a double check, you know?
Right.
Like being questioned, like, do you have the ability – how does that ability exactly work? Can you read it to me? And just being like, why can't you just trust me? Like, it's not a matter of trust. It is a very complicated system that bears another set of eyes, you know? Like – not just in business, but I was trained early on in my college years when I was doing big event planning and stuff like that. Like, I had a guy who oversaw all this stuff, and his main thing was, like, two eyes on everything, because, like, it's so easy for things to slip through by the most well-meaning, most conscientious, most focused person. Can make mistakes that can easily be mitigated by just one other person taking a look at it as well. You know?
Oh my God. With a small company like what we have to try to apply that to everything. Two eyes on everything.
I mean, we have task assignments within our company that are laid out that somebody does something and then somebody else just looks at it before it's said to be done. You know, it just double checking is hugely important to high quality. And so, anyway, I want people to call me on rules always and ask me about my abilities always so that I make sure I'm getting it right. I get wording wrong all the time. We make fun of Matthew for doing it. I do it as well. Miss a sentence in the middle. I'm reading fast and I skip one little part. You know, a great example is dimensional assault. We talked about a dimensional assault last week. Like, when Sydney did it and I just kind of, like, read through it, I didn't see the part where it's like, and make a strike. Yeah. That's a huge difference. I just assumed it was a movement ability, you know?
And you have to make that strike. The ruling's out. You so, do have to
so
make that.
So thank you to everybody who responded last week. I think probably the – I just pulled one out, and that was Dana Mirsky. Dana Mirsky says dimensional assault does force one to make that strike. There is a 10th level feat called dimensional disappearance that allows you to forego that strike. Amazing. So thank you all for pointing that out in the comments last week.
Did you let Sydney know?
Yes, I will let – no, I'm going to – no. I want her to look stupid on air. No, of course – I will let her know. Let's go into We Are Stupid. Just a couple things this week, and then we're on to listener mail.
We are stupid.
Thank you, Nicholas. All right, really light one this week. First of all, coming right off of our conversation about the rule correcting, Professor Eric. Clean bill of health on the whole climb out of the pit situation where we
wow.
ended up on it.
And the falling damage too, because I saw some people take umbrage with the way we did.
I ran out of time before this FOD to question him on the damage, where some people said she took no damage and some people said she did take damage. I am curious to see this week where that irons out. He'll get back to us on that, and we'll talk about it in next week's FOD. But okay. It was a little back and forth. Professor Eric doesn't mention it at all. So I believe usually when he doesn't mention it, it means we did something right. So the fact that she
20-foot fall, first 10, you don't take damage. And the second 10 was covered by her cat's fall or whatever it is. So the question is, does the only question is if those things don't stack,
right,
then would she take damage? And we ruled it that they do.
And then there's also the question. Yeah. And then there's also the question. No, we ruled it that they don't, but that they were prone. Right. And so the question is, if you don't with catfall, if you don't take damage, you don't go prone. But we had her go prone and take damage from the spikes because there wasn't a flat floor to land on. It really is a little bit tricky, but Eric didn't address it on this one. Write us back, Eric, and let us know. And we'll talk about it next week. Let's talk about the phase bolt cantrip, which Sydney mentioned. This is just a remaster mention. The phase bolt that she had to do because this creature like leapt away from her. Like she was moving to the creature, got to it, and then it just like zipped away from her on the other side of the room. So she could no longer do a melee attack. So Sydney casts this cool spell, phase bolt cantrip, out of her katana. Bam! Very cool little cantrip that seems to like ignore some cover, which I thought was really cool. Anyway, it has been updated to be 3d4 piercing damage as opposed to 1d4 plus your spellcasting modifier. So it had a higher floor before, but now it has a higher ceiling. So there is the potential for up to 12 damage from that cantrip, which is nice. But I'll make sure that Sid is aware of that. All right. The only thing that we're going to talk about this week in We Are Stupid is leaping, which I brought up and then the table, et cetera. And so Professor Eric lays out and says, I feel you will very commonly see a couple of options in how this is done at the table. One of the easiest, and this is his number one at the top, is just call those squares difficult terrain. This is probably the most common approach I see for furniture in rooms, especially if it's just for traversal. If people are wanting to fight on top of the table, like if they want to jump on the table and fight from there, I think you'll see the leap action required more often. But generally, if they're trying to move across the room and there's a chair in the way or there's a table in the way, most GMs are saying just do that as difficult terrain.
It's the easy way for sure.
Yeah. Now, there is another rule set, which is the combined movement rules from the Game Master's Guide, which basically says that as a two-action activity, you can combine two forms of movement that lets you split the stride around non-stride movement actions. So moving and climbing, for example, it's like you could do one two-action thing that allows you to split this movement among different kinds of speed types. He thinks that depending on Asta's speed, she could have – in one leap action, literally leaped the table and landed on the other side without having to move at all.
Interesting.
Because of the horizontal leap rules. He doesn't think she had the room for a long jump, but yes, he says, in summary, a strict ruling of three actions to traverse the table is possible and might incentivize learning the leap or long jump rules or investing in quick jump, which is a feat that allows you, I believe, to – sorry, I didn't have it up. But I believe it allows you to leap without the running time.
I got it right here. You can use high jump and long jump as a single action instead of two actions.
If you do, you don't perform the initial stride, nor do you fail if you don't stride 10 feet. Yeah, so you don't need to do the run up to the jump. Anyway, it's like penalizing that movement by making it really difficult with extra actions, it rewards that feat greater than if you just call things difficult terrain, you know.
Yeah.
He says, however, I think basically table ruling a two-action activity if people don't have a quick alternative in mind is probably in the most in the spirit of the rules and the available options that keeps the game rolling. So you just say, yes, you can just get over the table, but it takes you an extra action to do it. Or depending on how far they want to go or how big the thing is, you could just make it difficult terrain. Anyway, so cool. that they laid it out, a lot of options. Thank you, Eric, for digging into the leap action and how it can be used. All right, let's go in a listener mail here before we wrap up. Thank you to the Nays for reaching out and sending us your questiones.
It's time for listener mail. Gotta get your brain up on it. Time for listener mail.
Thank you, Nikolai. All right. So what was I just going to say? Oh, remember, listener mail. If you want to get your listener mail in here, you can email us at contact@glasscannonnetwork.com with your question. Put listener mail in the subject line, or you can go to our website. And there's a form on there for listener mail where you can submit right through the web. All right. Let's kick it off with Roman Rush from Toronto. You guys want to be in the Toronto St. Patrick's Day Parade? It's on Sunday at noon. I might have some connections. Could be a laugh.
Could you imagine
us in the parade?
Gorgeous. Do you know that Comic-Con is happening in Toronto this weekend? Like Toronto Comic-Con?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I keep forgetting
that's
to
a
like,
coincidence?
Mention that. Yeah, I would love to say it was part of our strategy. But no, it's happening. And I don't know. Maybe you want to go.
Maybe.
I kind of want to go to Raptors Magic. Anybody have any Raptors Magic tickets for Friday night?
Oh, there's a Raptors Magic game Friday night?
It's the only professional sports game happening that weekend. But it's Friday night, so.
Well, it's probably not sold out, right?
No, but they're two fun teams.
Just got a couple floor-side ticks, bro.
Just a couple court-sides
We're sold out. On the cup?
A couple court-sides on the cup?
Dude,
we'll pay for our own drinks.
We'll consider it advertising. Just seeing us court-side on the broadcast is huge for the network.
Let's see who's in the audience tonight. Oh, the Glass Cannon Live team. Kiss cam.
Amazing. Thank you, Robin. Look forward to seeing you at the show. You better be at the show. All right. Dan Connolly from Warwick, UK.
Oh, International Dan Connolly. Edition.
No question here, just a comment. Hi, folks. I am loving Time for Chaos. Every single one of those characters is my favorite, and the group dynamics bring me such joy. In the most recent ep, the entertainment in The Laughing Horse also turned out to be a surprise nugget of joy. My grandmother grew up in rural Ireland, and as a young girl, loved listening to some of the Whistlers of the day. One of the last times I saw her, we put on a recording of Fred Lowery whistling the William Tell Overture from the 1930s. It's an impressive piece of whistling and is on YouTube for the curious.
That's amazing.
But for me, it was lovely to find that memory in an unexpected place. Thanks to everyone at the GCN for all your amazing work. I just thought I had to mention that because that is wild.
Well, you know, what's funny is like where they are right now is like this. It's all real. It's all historically, relatively historically accurate. And they're in this like village just to the north of London. And I've seen a bunch of comments of people have been like, I've been to that hill. I've been to that. Da, da, da. I've been to that town. It's really, really interesting. It's such a different show than anything we produce. The vibe is so wildly different with that cast, but the people who
you don't
love,
have any assholes correcting people's rules around after.
Dude, nobody knows the rules. It's such a different vibe, and the people who love Time for Chaos. Just they love Time for Chaos. They really, really love it. I see it in the comments every week. It has its own like definitely niche audience, but the people who love it, and it like inspires me to keep pushing along with it because it is such a mountain of work. But the players are having so much fun, and it's been a hell of a season so far.
That's great.
We
That's
had
great.
A couple big laughs on last week's after just some classic NPC. And it was a drunk NPC, which is always my my forte. But man, we had Nora and Kate look like they like. At one point, Nora's laughing so hard, she says, "My soul has left my body."
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right, last question here. Seth from St. Louis. This is something we've talked about.
St. Louis Seth.
Old St. Louis Seth. This is something we've talked about a little bit, but I love the way that this has been narrowed into a very specific question, and I think that it bears discussing. Hello, Joe and Troy. I am the GM for a group that is new to the Pathfinder scene, making the switch from 5e. I really like the recall knowledge skill check, and I think it's a really cool ability, and I want the players at my table to incorporate it more into their play. The thing I really struggle with is knowing what skill they should use. I don't really see anything listed in the monster stat block about it, and I'm always just like, nature should work. Any advice? I think it's a great question, Seth. It is certainly something I struggled with at the start of playing 2E. It's not that I'm done struggling with it. But it is intentionally nebulous, I feel like, intentionally vague. And that can be difficult for a GM, especially a GM that is used to a system where there's 700 pages of rules so that you don't have to have questions about what the rules are or how something should be interpreted, especially something as common as a knowledge check. Troy, do you have any initial comments on this? Otherwise, I can keep talking about it.
Yeah, I don't like it. I like strict. I don't like nebulous. You know what I mean? It's like, why it bothers me with a system. This isn't like a dig at Pathfinder, but it bothers me that like there's so many strict rules for everything else. Why have any nebulous rules? I don't like it. But the way that I've sort of rectified it, and we still like stumble through it on the show, is like every monster, if you look, it'll say like DC 17 occult. DC 15 nature for a recall knowledge, DC 13 arcana. Those are the DCs if you use those skills. And so if you want to use any other skill, I'm perfectly fine with you using it. But the DC is going to go up in my head based on how close it is to the thing. So if it's a cult and you roll religion, the DC is probably not going to be that much higher. It's going to be a little higher because that's not the correct skill, but a cult and religion are so closely related, I'm keeping that DC in the ballpark. If it's a cult and you want to use nature, I got to look and be like, was nature really something for this particular monster that is going to make sense? 9 times out of 10, if it's a cult, probably not. So now the DC is going to be up even higher. Same thing with like arcana and nature, religion. Religion is so specific. Like if it's not religion, and you, all you have is religion, your DC is probably going to be a lot higher unless you're dealing with a monster that, you know, you could argue has some connection to there. But that's just how I've been playing it. I'm very fortunate with Foundry VTT. I look, the monster, the recall knowledge is right there. It tells me what it is. And I just go by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that overall that is a good system. If you feel like go with your gut, you know what? Okay. Hold on. Let me back up to the first thing you said, which was, why is there this vague part when it's such a rules heavy system?
No, that I just don't like that.
Yeah, that you just don't like it. I respect that.
And I've never liked that.
I do like it. And I like it because I feel like this is where Pathfinder makes an effort to acknowledge that every situation is so wildly different at every table and in every moment that you – it's very hard to write clear rules for every situation. And recall knowledge, I guess they feel, is vague enough that you should leave it up to the GM to take care of. I really think that overall there's a mentality that has to happen here that's really important, which is you as the GM interpret the rules and then you execute those rules. If you have done your research and recall knowledge and you see that there is just not the clear indication on what you should do, then you pick. And you just have to pick it and not worry about whether you're right or wrong. You're right because you're the GM, you know? Now, Troy's interpretation of it is these are the skills that I think are most directly related to the thing. In this case, there's a module where it says what they are. If people want to roll something else, I will bump up the DC. That's the exact interpretation I would take. That is exactly how I would run it at my table. To give you just a very brief overview of how I would think about it in my head, splitting these monsters, and particularly when it comes to monster ID, among the knowledge checks and which ones should be the lowest DCs of all, I take this from 1E. And so perhaps as a 5e player, you never played 1e. 1e had a little bit more clear definition of what monsters come under what skills, but some of those skills don't really exist anymore. So you have to do a little bit of tweaking, but here's the way that I think about it. Religion's single largest area of concern is going to be deities and their respective organizations and undead.
Undead.
Undead is where you're going to get the most out of your religion, because undead is a very large and frequent monster in these style fantasy, high fantasy games. Nature for me is anything about the natural world, no matter how strange or weird, as long as it's not magical, as long as it's not magical in nature, it's natural nature. And so obviously that's a huge subject that could cover a lot of different creatures, but mainly animals, right? Animals, even if they're like a little jacked up in a weird way or infected by something that makes them supernaturally large or something like that, like nature. Occultism is obviously a little bit of a tricky one. Occultism to me, and I spoke with Eric Mona about this, I remember years ago, and asking him, like, how do you differentiate arcana from occultism and religion from occultism? Like, where does it separate out? And the primary thing that he said to me at the time was that it has to do largely with mystical, supernatural, mythical. So basically things that even in this magical world are unknown to large amounts of people, including people that are trained in arcana. So like magic is not strange just because it's magic. A lot of magic is mundanely taught and learned in schools, right? In this world for wizards. The occult is about the secret things, the things that most people don't know about and even trained people don't learn about because they are actively kept secret. Supernatural things. And this is gatewalkers. You see a lot of occultism in gatewalkers because I also said, how do you define supernatural in a world where everything is supernatural? It's fantasy, you know? Right. And Eric is actually the one that disabused me of this notion. He's like, no. All of that stuff that you know, magical schools, arcane spell casting, primal spells, you know, all of that kind of magical, fantastic dragons, all that stuff is natural in this world. It is the natural state of this world. So when we talk about the occult, we talk about the things that even in this world are supernatural, which is, so you're getting to a whole other degree. And it's the things that nobody talks about, the things that nobody wants to know about, the things that make people in a, you know, the average family in a home uncomfortable to hear about. Like, you know, they know there's dragons out there. That doesn't make them uncomfortable. They might be uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable if there's a dragon flying over the village. Mm-hmm. But knowing the existence of dragons might not bother them. But knowing the existence of a great old one might bother them, right? Like, these are things that are outside of the normal realm of the natural in this world. So, and then obviously arcana, magical beasts, creatures of pure magic, magical creatures, whatever. And then the whole point is any one of them can sort of like cross over into the other wherever you see fit. So it is the GM's not only job, but right. It is your right to decide what somebody can and can't roll on those. And if you don't want to say no to your players, I think Troy's idea is a great one, which is just bump up the DCs. Make the DC harder if you feel like the area of expertise is too fringe to really reach over and grab the information you need from this particular area. But it's a great question and one that we all at one point or another have struggled with.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we just kind of like, I don't know, at least in my learning of the system, I've just constantly overlooked because I'm not, I don't know, it's just one of those things like, I'm just not interested. And then it comes up in a game and I'm like, man, I really need to take a peek at this. But I'm just looking right now at your actual skills. You've got arcana, things that would be relevant for, because
personally, like Brother Ramius?
No, I'm just looking at like the skills. So there's arcana, nature, occultism, religion.
Those are really the primary knowledge skills. Now, you can recall knowledge with anything, right?
And lore. Like, lore is – nobody burns on lore. But I guess you could recall knowledge on medicine. But that's to recall about diseases, injuries, poisons, and other ailments. Not really for monsters per se. But if you were going up against some like crazy doctor, you could be like, can I do medicine? I'd be like, all right. You know, I know that's not what it's going to say in the stat block, but if you nail a medicine check, you'd be like, well, all right, so you don't really know what this monster is. It never showed up in any medical textbooks that you read, but like you do see some accoutrements on his like person. It kind of looks like he has some toxins. Maybe he's got a poison weapon. Maybe he has the ability to throw those. You know, so there's always ways that you can game the system. It's just how much
society too. We forgot society.
Society, yeah. Society is like,
so society is
like
general,
knowledge local, basically.
Yeah, it's a general catch-all for like humans, humanoids, and then society in general. But
yeah, like Bolon was society, but he was so specific, it was a harder check because you would have had to have read something in your study about Bolon specifically to really nail a society check. Oh, you know what? When you were at the Quaking Stacks, you saw a little tidbit about – you found Bolon's bio.
Bolon's bio. His Lincoln bio.
Bolon's eHarmony profile.
Amazing.
Carries a plus one staff.
You can also you know, use checks outside of those for recall knowledge. You can, as long as you can justify it. And that's one of the things I like about that system. To me, it's reminiscent of Blades in the Dark, where, you know, the GM is saying to you, what do you want to roll for this? And if you can justify why, right? You know, just like if you're fighting a circus acrobat and you don't want to use society, you're not trained in it, but you're highly trained, you're an expert in acrobatics, why couldn't you roll acrobatics to know what they might be capable of or what you can see? Or if it's a more of a sneaky mission, right? And you're like, I want to roll knowledge acrobatics on this circus performer to see like, how do they probably do their training and like, where would it happen? And I could corner them somewhere. Some like getting creative with those things is really fun. And as a GM, I think letting people express that creativity is great. Yeah. You just need to like, if you think that it's a long shot, just say, absolutely, go for it. And then in your head, just tick up that DC a few points and make it harder to hit. They have to get a high roll on the check to make it worthwhile, you know? So anyway.
Dude, yeah, I do that shit all the time. Like, yeah, roll it. And I'm like, I don't care what you roll. Unless you roll a 20, I'm not telling you shit. It's the same thing when someone like goes to do an attack that I totally disagree with and like I don't feel like getting into a fight. I'm like, all right, roll. Oh, how much damage? Great.
No damage.
No damage. And now you're not going to fight anymore, and I don't have to deal with your bullshit.
That's why they have a GM screen. That's why they have a GM screen. What happens behind the screen stays behind the screen. Oh, man, that'll be a good one for one day. We should talk more about secretly not taking any damage, like, after you said you took
damage. It's better than picking a fight. Like, you know you're right, or even if you don't know you're right, you're the GM. All right, dude, sick hit. What was that? 30, you said? 30 points of damage? Holy shit. He's in rough shape. Listen back. It's all over the Glass Cannon podcast.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it for the FOD. Thanks for hanging out with us this week. Like we said, juicy FOD coming next week. Join us and save the date if you're a VoIPL subscriber or become one. Wednesday, March 20 to 7:30 Eastern, a talk show with Jared and I where your voice is heard. Come up to the stage. Talk to us. It's going to be great. Until then, have a great one, everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. We'll see you in Toronto. Bye!
It's time to make your membership official. Become an official member of The Naish today at jointhenaish.com. That's jointhenaish.com, where you'll get access to exclusive podcasts and live streams you can't find anywhere else. See what everybody's talking about and join The Naish today at jointhenaish.com.